Morning, Cross Line. How are we feeling? All right, let's go. Awake and alive this morning. I love it. My name is Clint. I'm one of the pastors here on staff at Crossline. So excited to be with you this morning and excited to continue our series that we've been in called The Big Ten. Basically, what we've been doing this summer is we've been going through the Ten Commandments and taking a little bit of a deeper dive and deeper look at them, because I think for many of us, the Ten Commandments feel like they're stuck in time. You know, they feel like they're still just written on stone tablets and they should be in a museum somewhere, and we just take a lot of them at face value. But there's actually a lot going on that God is trying to do with us through these Ten Commandments. There's a lot of wisdom in these Ten Commandments. And so we've been taking this summer and looking through, okay, how do these actually still look in our lives today? What's the big wisdom that God's got underneath these commands? And so this week, we're going to be talking about Command 7. We are in week 8 of our series. And so for those of you who are like really good at math and you've been thinking this already, you're like, wait, it's week 8, but we're on Command 7. That's not enough weeks. You are correct. The last week, we're going to combine the last two commandments in the last week as they connect in a really interesting way that you guys will see at the end of the series. So don't miss out on that. And as we've been going through these commands, part of what we said is the first four commands that we went through, the first four of the Ten Commandments, those are really commands about how we relate to God, like our relationship with God and how that is supposed to work. And then commands 5 through 10 are really about how we relate to each other, how we have right relationship with other people, how we have righteousness with each other. And so that's what we're going to kind of continue. And there's wisdom underneath all of these commands that can really help guide our actions as we interact with each other. And also they honor God at the same time. And like, truthfully, I think that we need this wisdom more now than ever, because we have come to a weird place as like humans and society. Okay. We want some great things, and we have some great things going for us. Like, we want equal rights, we want equal access, we want to be seen as more than just a number, and those are all incredible things, and yes, let's go after those. And at the same time, we tend to rate people like they are a toaster that we just bought on Amazon, right? Like, we do both of those things at the same time. We hold both of those as true. I mean, think about it. Everybody has a score nowadays, right? Your Uber driver's got a score. Your DoorDash guy has a score. Your plumber has a score. The babysitter has a score. The person who cuts your hair has a score. Like, we're basically just all walking around with like a little number above our head that like rates our usefulness in society, right? And look, I'm as guilty as this as anybody. If somebody comes and picks me up in an Uber, I am immediately evaluating everything about them, right? I am getting in this car. I'm thinking about how clean this car is. I'm thinking about, did they greet me? Were they just silent? Don't be silent. That's weird. Now I want to rate you less, right? I don't want to give you as big of a tip. Like, what kind of music are you playing? Are you playing trap music? Because I don't want to listen to that this whole ride, you know? And so I'm thinking about all of those things, and I'm evaluating my Uber driver just as much as anybody else is. And we're not immune to this either. I don't know if you know this, but you also have a score. Like, if you've ever gotten in a ride share, whether it's an Uber or Lyft, you also have a rating. They rate you as well, right? And look, I don't know exactly what their criteria is. I know what mine is. But one time I got into an Uber and I had a ride or whatever, and I got out and I saw that the Uber gave me 4 stars instead of 5 stars. And I was so offended. I was like, first of all, sir, I am delightful, okay? And secondly, I tipped you. Like, why on earth would you give me 4 stars? I was so mad. And you know, this is just becoming normal, right? Like, it's weird when you kind of just think about it and talk about it. But truthfully, this isn't really strange to us anymore. We just kind of accept that this is how people work now, right? You are your usefulness, and so is everybody else to a certain extent. And I think once we learn to do this with an Uber driver, we can do that with anybody. And honestly, I think we've been doing this a long time before Uber came around. I mean, think about it. You meet somebody, and within a minute, you have already quietly assessed what they can do for you, right? Are they useful? Are they interesting? Are they worth my time, right? And most of the time, we're not necessarily even aware that we're doing it. It's just how we learn to move through a world with a lot of people in it. But the problem is, like, ratings are okay and all this stuff, but the thinking behind here goes to some interesting places. Watch where this kind of thinking can go. It can go to dating, where people are browsed, where you scroll through somebody's social media and judge them before you ever truly engage with them as a person. where somebody, you know, dating, where somebody becomes a list of attributes that you evaluate against a specification sheet that you have already made, where you can dismiss a whole human being in under a minute because of a photo on their Instagram. It goes to marriage, where after the shine wears off, a spouse slowly stops being a person you're getting to know and becomes a set of functions, right? Do they still make me feel good? Are they holding up their end of the bargain? And I don't think we decide to do that. I think sometimes we just wake up one day and realize that the last five conversations we had with our spouse were all about logistics. It goes to what we consume. I mean, there's an entire industry built on giving you access to human beings who are there to be purely looked at, used, and then exited out of. It goes to how we talk, the jokes that turn a person into a punchline, the comments about a body, the way we discuss people who aren't in the room, like they're just characters in our story and not people with a soul. And I don't think any of us are waking up in the morning and intentionally trying to act like monsters, right? But this is just sort of normal day-to-day life now. I mean, think about this. We are the most connected generation in all of human history, and we've never been better at treating people like content. And so here's what's actually going on underneath all of this. Underneath all of this, what we're doing is we're taking humans made in the image of God and turning them into things that we use. We're taking humans made in the image of God and we are turning them into things that we use. We are reducing people. That's what we're really doing. And this is exactly how Israel was seen and treated when they were slaves in Egypt. Because remember, the Ten Commandments is actually God teaching Israel, who he has just rescued from 400 years of slavery, he's actually teaching them how to be free people and to live life to the fullest. That's what the Ten Commandments are really about. It's not just a set of rules. And Pharaoh, while they were slaves in Egypt, did not see Israel or the people of Israel as image bearers. He saw them as free labor. He saw them as output. He saw them as bricks per day, right? Because they weren't people in Egypt. They were just units of production. And Israel didn't just come out of slavery. They came out of 400 years of being treated like things instead of humans. And so what does God do? He rescues them. And he brings them to the foot of this mountain. And he stands before them. And he starts describing what it looks like to be a truly free people, to live as a free people are supposed to be his people. And that's where we get today's commandment. Two words in Hebrew, lo tanaf, don't commit adultery. And most of us, we probably hear that, and just like last week's command, don't murder, we think, not me, check, right? Can check that off the list. Never had an affair. Some of you guys are like, I'm single, I'm not even married, can't even mess this one up, you know? I'm good. Next commandment. And now some of you came in this morning like bracing for this one. And maybe it's because you've been burned by a marriage, or maybe you got burned by a church that talked a big game and then covered up something ugly. Or maybe you're here and you're just thinking this whole conversation is outdated and that two consenting adults should get to define their own relationship without some ancient book having a say, right? If that's where you're at, I encourage you to stay with me this morning and watch where this actually goes before you decide that it's not for you. Because God is not just protecting an institution here. He's actually protecting something that he designed, that he formed with his own hands, and that he brought together and joined together himself. A relationship where two image bearers are supposed to be fully known and never reduced. And I don't think we can truly understand the weight that this commandment carries until we see God's full design for marriage. And so that's where we're going to start in the scriptures this morning. And to see that, we got to go all the way back to Genesis, which is one of my favorite books in the Bible. It's got a lot of good stuff in there. And we're going to start in Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, we're going to see something interesting here that I don't know if you've ever noticed before. I found this as I was studying and getting prepared for this message, and so I wanted to share this with you guys. Starting in chapter 1, verse 27. So God created human beings in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. Now, we're going to do a little bit of Bible study here together, all right? I'm going to show you guys something. I need you to know that the Bible is intentional, and what's written in it is intentional, right? So, like, the writer of Genesis didn't have, like, a writing stutter and just, like, write the same thing three times. Like, he wasn't running out of ideas and being like, ah, how do I say the same thing three different ways, right? Like he did this on purpose, right? And so there's three statements here, and all three of these statements have two things that are going on, right? So in each statement, what's he doing? He's making human beings, right? He created human beings. He created them three times, right? Well, what's the other side of the statement? In the image of God, right? So the first one, so God created human beings in his image, right? Second one, in the image of God, he created them. Third one, male and female, he created them. That's an interesting change. And if you think it's not on purpose, you need to learn how to read the Bible. So what's going on here? God is saying something really unique about men and women. That not only are we both, as men and women, equal bearers of the image of God, created in God's image, we also, together, uniquely, because we're different, because men and women are different, and we're wired up differently, because of that, we actually represent the fullness of God in a unique way together. Starting to say something really cool about marriage here. And then if you start to fast forward, and so like what Genesis 1 here is saying, we image God as different and one, right? That's an important thing to understand what God is trying to get at here in Genesis chapter 1, verse 27. Genesis says humanity images God as male and female, and the difference isn't a problem to solve. It's actually part of the picture. And we start to see that played out in a more intimate way in Genesis chapter 2. See, Genesis chapter 2 actually gives you like a zoomed in version of what's going on in Genesis chapter 1. And so in Genesis chapter 2, all the creation's happening. God makes Adam, aka that means human in Hebrew. He makes man, right? And what does he do? He said, it looks at man, it says, it's not good for man to be alone. First time God says something is not good in the Bible is when he sees man alone, right? And so what does he do? He puts on his anesthesiologist hat and he puts Adam to sleep, right? It's like, night, night, Adam. And Adam goes to bed. And while he's there, he takes the rib from Adam. And so from Adam to, right, man and woman. And he wakes Adam up. And as God is taking Adam's rib, says he's going to make a helper for him. Most versions translate this as helper, right? Which is not a terrible translation. But I love the way the Bible Project translates the Hebrew here. They translate it as rescuer who corresponds. So not just did God make Adam a helper, but a rescuer who corresponds. Someone who is not identical, but matching precisely by being different. I love that vision. And then what happens? Adam wakes up and he gets so excited. He's like, finally, this one is flesh of my flesh and bone of my bone, right? And then the narrator of Genesis steps back in and he says, this is why a man leaves his father and mother and clings to his wife, and the two become one flesh, right? And this is not just sex that the Bible is talking about here. This is a new family bond. Two lives fuse into one thing. And so marriage actually joins two image bearers into one image-bearing union, right? You start to form this new thing as you get married. Two image bearers forming the full image of the triune Godhead, right? God is three in one, and marriage is supposed to represent what that looks like. And so this is actually really, really important. And it's really, really special. And in Exodus, that union is protected with a commandment. And in Leviticus, it's protected with a penalty. Now, anybody study up on their Leviticus Old Testament law and know what the penalty for adultery is? Anybody know? All right, I heard a couple whispers. I didn't expect you guys to know, all right? I did not expect you to be like, hey, I just read all the Levitical laws and I'm ready for this week. Adultery carries the same punishment in Leviticus that murder does. It's the capital punishment of death. I want us to sit with that for just a second. Feel the weight of that. The penalty for adultery was death, placing it among Israel's most serious covenant violations. Now look, it doesn't mean that adultery and murder cause identical damage, but it does mean that adultery was never considered private and never considered harmless. And that's how a lot of times how it's treated today. What adultery does is it tears at that one flesh, image-bearing union that God himself joined together. And that brings with it, in the Old Testament, a serious penalty. And so we can start to see God's full vision for two image bearers becoming one. And how adultery tears at that and rips that apart. And as happened last week, what Jesus did with murder, well, he does here with adultery. He takes this command in the New Testament and he raises the bar to the heart level. He goes after what's at the heart here. What's really going on with adultery? And he does this not to crush us, but to show us where reduction ultimately equals destruction of the image of God. And then he starts to tell us to fight like it matters. And so we're going to pick up that in Matthew chapter 5, verse 27 through 30. This is what Jesus said in verse 27. You have heard the commandment that says, you must not commit adultery. Verse 28, but I say, anyone who even looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So if your eye, even your good eye, causes you to lust, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your hand, even your stronger hand, causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. I like how the NLT translates this one. This is like, if you only got one good eye, don't take the bad one out. Get the good one. Take it to the next level there, NLT. Jesus, what's he telling us here? He's telling us that unfaithfulness, that adultery starts long before anything physical happens. Which means that like window shopping is not okay. I've had several men as I was growing up. Thankfully, none of them were in the church. Praise the Lord, I didn't get this advice from a church guy. But they would tell me like, hey, you can look, you just can't touch. That was like, that's the like golden rule. Like, you know, hey, you know, it's all right. You can look, you just can't touch. And Jesus is saying, absolutely not. Like the opposite of that. Like, don't do that, right? And I want to be clear about what lust is here. Because lust is not attraction, okay? Attraction is normal. That's a normal human thing. It's okay to see a human and think, oh, that human is attractive. That's not lust. Lust is reduction. Lust happens when we start reducing a person. Lust is what happens when desire stops seeing a person and starts using one. That's what lust is. And Jesus says that that reduction destroys marriage, that it destroys relationships, that it reduces and destroys the image of God, that it's treating a person as a body or body parts or a fantasy or a quick fix for my desire. It's the moment someone stops being a person and starts becoming a thing. That is lust. And look, in you know, practical everyday life, you can notice people, right? Like your eyes will go from person to person for a myriad of reasons, right? So you can see somebody walking down the street, oh, identify a person, they walk by, okay. But then, you know where you get in trouble? It's the second look, all right? The person walks by and you're like, actually, you know what? Yeah. You guys know what I'm talking about, all right? Don't act like you don't know what I'm talking about. You know the second look. That right there is where you start getting in trouble. The long gaze, the evaluation of a body, the looking through, finding that person on Instagram and looking through all of their pictures, right? The thoughts of fantasy, that is lust. And it is image destroying. That's what we talk about. That's what I mean when we're reducing the image of God. And Jesus says it's adultery. Now look, not every time we reduce somebody is it sexual sin, but every act of lust begins with reduction. The moment a whole person becomes something we use. And so question for us is, when we look at someone, do we still see someone made by God, or do we only see what we want from them? When we're looking at a person, we see them as somebody made by God, or only what we want from them? And look, if you rolled in this morning thinking you're safe because you're not married, let me burst your bubble here for a second, okay? Because here's the truth. You guys need to understand the truth about marriage. Marriage actually starts a long time before you say I do. Marriage does not and cannot fix you. What marriage does is marriage reveals you. And all my married people can say amen, because y'all know I'm speaking the truth. Thank you. Marriage doesn't fix you. Marriage reveals you. And so if you are somebody who reduces people now, you'll do it in your marriage. If you don't have a grip on this and a handle on this now, it's not going to all of a sudden change just because you get married. And I'm going to dig in here, and I'm going to get real, and I'm going to get honest, because I don't know any other way to be. So if y'all know me, you know that's true. This lust, this carries, this reduction, it carries the heaviest penalty in our sexuality. And in our world, lust is rampant. It's everywhere. And our world is set up to bring you into it. It just is. And I'm going to speak to men here for a second, because I have sat with, talked with, counseled, and met with more men and young men who struggle with this, who are trapped in this, who are trapped by this, who are being destroyed by lust, than I haven't. Like, there's just, I haven't had many guys that I've run into that aren't in the middle of this fight. And so I want to speak to you for a second. First, I've been there. I know what you're going through. I know how difficult it is. I know. But guys, if you are looking at pornography or thirst trap videos or anything in between, what you are doing on that screen is destroying you actively. As you reduce women to something that you are using, you are being reduced as a man. You are losing part of being a man while you stay trapped in that. And for so many guys, shame is just a big part of this. You haven't told anybody. You keep it a secret because you're afraid of the consequences. You're afraid of what people will think if they find out. You're afraid of the work that it's going to take to get out of it. You don't want to lose your little secret sin. And shame just keeps you locked up in there. It keeps you from freedom. Don't let a habit or an addiction keep you from experiencing the life that God designed you for and the marriage that he has for you. Because as long as you're in that, you're not going to experience it. And look, in our time, men's sexuality is like the place where this is the most evident. It's very, like, it's probably not the first time you've heard something like this, right? I get it. But it's not the only place that is being hurt by reducing. And women, don't hear this as a men's only problem that you get to sit out of, okay? Because I'd seen the data. And the data says that women are struggling with this just as much as men are nowadays. It's not quite even, but it's close. Lust is what Jesus calls out, right? But here's the thing about lust. This habit of how we see people, it doesn't stay small. It doesn't stay locked in this little area of our sexuality, right? And that's the big problem with it. It's not just sexual, and it doesn't just affect marriage. What's underneath all of this is the same move that we talked about with the 5-star rating, the spec sheet that we're evaluating people with, the punchline. Anytime we reduce people, the image of God, we are in danger. And that's why this comes right after the discourse on anger. This is not a mistake, right? Again, the Bible is intentionally designed. God didn't just like randomly throw it together. Right here in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' most famous set of teachings, what does he do? He's going through a couple of commandments. You know, he only picks 2 commands out of the 10 commandments to expand on? Murder and adultery. Why do you think that is? Those are the two that are easiest for people, most people, to bypass, right? Oh, I haven't done that one. I'm good. And so Jesus gets at the heart of what's going on here. Last week we talked about murder. Jesus talks about anger. He says anybody who calls somebody an idiot is in danger of the fires of hell. Why? Because they're taking an image of God and reducing it to a problem, to an obstacle, to a hurdle to get over. No, that's a person. And then he says, oh, you think you're safe because you haven't done that? He's like, if you've ever looked at somebody and thought, how about I want to use them? You thought about how you want to fantasize about that person, and you've reduced that image. Same thing. There's the same things going on here. That's why Jesus is calling it out, right? And so here's the truth. What we rehearse in private trains how we see people in public. What we rehearse in private trains how we see people in public. And so the question we need to wrestle with is, what is your private life training you to see when you look at people? What is your private life training you to see when you look at people? Whatever your version of the screen is, the story, the comparison, the fantasizing about the person who likes all of your posts, same reduction, same cost. If you're measuring people or your spouse by what they do for you or how they contribute, you are reducing who God has created and what God has created you guys to be. If when you think about your spouses, all you ever think about is like, did they do the dishes today? Is the money coming in? Are the kids all right? Like, you're missing the image there. You're reducing them to a set of functions, and you are missing what you are created to be together. And then we get to the part that, like, we all like to skip, right? Because Jesus doesn't stop at a diagnosis. No, what does he say? He says, if your good eye is causing you to sin, gouge it out, right? If your good hand, your good arm is causing you to sin, cut it off. And look, guys, that's hyperbole, okay? Like, I don't want anybody leaving here. Clint said it, you know? Don't do that. I don't want any, like, social media blow-ups, all right? This is hyperbole. Jesus is not recommending self-mutilation, all right? I want to be very clear about that. But he is commanding urgency and action, right? He does want you to do something serious. He does want you to do something decisive and radical. He wants you to take whatever it takes action, right? For example, my phone here. You know, our phone sometimes like our right hand, right? I don't know how many of you guys, I don't know what your screen time looks like. Mine's a little high for comfort sometimes, right? We use it for everything. But if this thing right here is causing me to sin, if this is the thing that I can't escape, that every time I try, it just keeps coming back, you know what I need to do? I need to get rid of it. It needs to go. Whatever it takes. Now, I probably could have just deleted some apps and maybe got some screen accountability. Kids, please don't go out and smash your phone. All right, I don't want a call from your parents. What's my point? We treat this like a struggle to manage. Jesus treats it like a war to win. That's a big difference. This isn't something that we struggle and wrestle with for the rest of our lives. This is a war that we declare victory in, and that God sets a path for victory in. You don't have to stay trapped in this. You don't have to stay stuck like this. You can actually, through the power of the Holy Spirit, transform your life in this area. Because it's so damaging, so destructive, it carried the same penalty that murdered it. And it's worth doing whatever it takes to eliminate this from your life. Because we see as God's, how we see God's people as his image, that is worth protecting. Your marriage, the context where two people are learning to become fully loving human beings, where love stops being a feeling and starts becoming a practice, that is worth protecting. Other people's marriage, where you might be tempted to come in as an emotional rescue or fulfill a need that is not yours to fulfill, that relationship is worth protecting. And look, if you're here and you're feeling defeated, as you realize just how deep this thing goes for you, I just want you to know that there's hope. And that hope starts by realizing that shame is not a tool of Jesus. He's not trying to shame us here. Conviction says, hey, what you're doing is wrong and there's a better life for you. Shame says you are what you did and there's no escape. That's a totally different thing. That's not what Jesus brings. And how do I know that? Well, because the same Jesus who said this about adultery also was the same guy who in John chapter 8 verse 10 stands with a woman who was caught in adultery. And this woman was dragged out into a town square in front of everybody who was ready to stone her. They were ready to do some Levitical justice. And Jesus kneels down. And we see in John 8, chapter 8, verse 10 through 11, Jesus says, "Where are your accusers? Don't even one of them condemn you?" "No, Lord," she said. And Jesus looks at her and he says, "Neither do I. Go and sin no more." That line is not shame. It's not condemnation. It's an invitation. Jesus, through his life, death, and resurrection, offers us grace, healing, and hope. And it is that same posture that Jesus had as he's looking at this woman caught. And then she had been reduced by everybody else that drug her out there as her mistake, as her failure. Everybody thought that except for Jesus. He knew everything. He knew the full unedited version. And he still won't look at her and give her a score. God looks at you this morning, knowing all of it. Every failure, all the habits, all the history, everything that you're hoping nobody ever finds out, he knows. And he doesn't rate you. He redeems you. That's what he wants. As a matter of fact, he goes so far as to bind himself to us. That's what Jesus does. Through his death and sacrifice, God actually binds himself to humanity. This is why Paul describes the church as a bride. Right? He's using the imagery of marriage that we talked about at the very beginning. We get to be one. We get to be fully known. We get to be fully loved and accepted by Jesus the exact way marriage was supposed to work since Genesis. God refuses to reduce you. And so he tells us to stop reducing others. And if you're here this morning, and you've never received that grace, you've never received that forgiveness, it's available to you right now. If you've never given your life to Jesus, if you walked away somewhere along the line and you've been sitting here this morning doing the math, thinking about whether you're too far gone or not, I want you to hear this. There is no version of you that he is unwilling to receive. No version, not the one that you've kept in the dark, not the one that made the mistake. There's no version of you that he wants to keep out. He knows already. He knows all of it, and he still came. You don't have to clean up first. You don't have to understand all of it. You just have to say yes and follow him. And so I want to give you a moment to do that. If that's you and you're here, would everybody bow your head and close your eyes? And if you're here this morning and you're ready to say yes, maybe for the first time, you're ready to receive that grace and forgiveness and give everything to God. I'm going to pray. And right from where you're at, your heart to God's, I'm going to pray. And you can use my words as your own. And you can say something like this. Dear Jesus, I need your grace and I need your forgiveness. I have been reducing people. And I don't want to go that way anymore. I repent of my sin. I believe that you are who you said you were. I believe that you lived. I believe that you died. And I believe that God raised you from the dead for the forgiveness of my sins. I put my life in your hands. I trust you. And I'm going to follow you for the rest of my days. In Jesus' name, Amen. So you've got a new start. Jesus doesn't condemn you, but go and sin no more, right? That's what he says. So how do we do this? How do we start to live this out? How do we protect people, refuse to reduce them, right? I got three things for you to do this week. One is confession. This is one of the most important things you can do in and around this topic, is confession. Today, not even later this week, today, confess to God. Tell him where you have missed on this one. And then take the brave step and tell one person that you trust the truth. Say it to God and say it to another person. Not someday, but today. Because here's the truth about this one. Shame dies in the light and grows in the dark. Satan, your enemy, wants you to keep things a secret so that just you and him can battle it. The moment you start to include God, the moment you start to include other people, he loses. And so the more you keep secrets, the more you keep things in the dark, the more you're going to battle and the more you're going to lose. Bring things into the light. Confess. Maybe you need to confess what you've been doing online. Maybe you've been consuming lustful content in all of its various forms, right? Maybe you've been reducing somebody and it's time to name them. Not some abstract version, God forgive me for reducing, but like, God, I've been reducing this person, right? A name, a face. Maybe it's your spouse. Maybe somewhere along the way, your spouse became a set of functions instead of a person. Maybe it's a coworker that you decided a long time ago was an obstacle instead of a person. Or you've been thinking about a coworker with lust. Or you've had a relationship that's gone to a place where you're giving your emotions to it, right? And thinking about, man, if I had only married them. It's time to confess. It's time to confess, because I know this. You won't stop doing something that you won't name. If you have something that's leading you down this road and you refuse to name it, you won't stop doing it. So that's step one. Step two, this is a brave one. Ask one honest question this week. If you're married, I got one question for you to ask your spouse, if you're feeling real brave, okay? Where do you feel unseen by me? That's a brave question. And look, if you're not married, I'm still including you here too. You didn't escape, all right? If you're not married, ask that same question to a roommate, a friend, a parent, your kids, whoever it is that's closest to you. Where do you feel unseen by me? And then, once you ask that question, this part's important, close your mouth, okay? Just listen. Don't explain, don't defend, don't fix it. Just listen and write it down and then go pray about it. But ask that brave question, where do you feel unseen by me? Because you can't start unreducing somebody, right? You can't start truly valuing and seeing somebody as the image of God that they are if you are unwilling to hear them. Once you start to hear people and truly understand what they're going through, then you can start to see them for who they are. And the last step is this. Cut something. This week, not eventually, cut something. Jesus said, gouge it out and cut it off. Now again, he wasn't being literal, but he was being urgent. And that's important. And so what's the thing? What's the thing for you? Is it the app? Is it the account? Is it the algorithm that you've trained? Is it the route that you drive? Is it the friendship that's a little bit more than a friendship? Is it the show that you're watching that you know exactly why you're watching it? Like, what is it for you? Don't manage it. Don't set a limit on it. Don't bargain with yourself or explain things away. Humans are great rationalizers, right? Don't rationalize it. Cut it. Go after it. That's what Jesus says to do. And parents, as we get ready to close, one more closing thought for us. Our kids are building their entire definition of love out of how we talk and treat our spouse and how we talk about other people. That's the curriculum that we're teaching them. Whether we mean to or not, that's what they're seeing and that's what they're learning. So are we talking about our spouse and treating our spouse as a person and not an object? Are we talking about other people and treating other people like people and not just objects? Guys, marriage is worth protecting. It's worth going after. How we see people is worth guarding. And imagine what our homes would look like if nobody in them ever got reduced, right? Like if your spouse was somebody that you were still curious about instead of somebody you've already drawn a conclusion on. Imagine where your kids growing up, knowing that people aren't useless or useful. They are made in the image of God, and not because you have to tell them, but because they've seen you live it. Imagine a church full of people who refuse to do to each other what the world does to all of us. Where you walk in and nobody's doing the math on what you're worth to them. They just love you because you're made by the Lord. And that's not just a nice idea. That is what it looks like when free people start to live like free people. That's what the Ten Commandments are all about. That's the wisdom that's underneath them. And so as we get ready to close our service, would you prepare your hearts, prepare your minds to engage with the God who created you, who loves you, and seek him and seek that new vision for other people. Would you stand with us as we get ready to sing and praise God?